Hi, and welcome to another episode of the IQ and Human Intelligence Podcast. Today, my guest is Jonathan Anomaly, Director of Research and Communications at Heracite. We're going to have a great talk today about embryo selection and how intelligence fits into the wider biotechnology landscape. Thanks for joining me on the program today, Jonathan.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me.
You're the first guest we've had on the podcast who is not primarily an intelligence researcher. So please tell me about your training and your background so that we can understand how you approach these issues.
Sure. My training is mostly in philosophy and economics, and I taught in PPE programs. So that's more familiar to British listeners than Americans, but PPE is philosophy, politics, and economics. And the point of that discipline, and it is its own kind of discipline, is to both be able to model human behavior, to sort of understand how people respond to incentives, whether they be economic incentives, psychological incentives, and so on. But also, in the end, to be able to do something with that. So policymakers in England often study PPE because they want to understand the world and change it. But of course, it helps to be able, before you try to change the world, to sort of channel Marx's view. You know, he sort of criticizes philosophers as having only tried to study the world and not change it. The point is to change it, he says, you know. But actually, the point is both, right? Because if you want to change it, you also want to get things right first, human motivations and so on. And so, yeah, one of the sort of essential ways in which economists look at the world is people make rational decisions in some narrow sense of that word, in the sense that they understand their own preferences, their own budget constraints, their time constraints, and they choose accordingly, and we just define that as rational in economics, more or less efficiently pursuing your objectives. But when they do that individually, sometimes the collective pattern that emerges, the emergent order, as we say, is good from a social standpoint. Usually markets lead to those outcomes, right? You're each pursuing your own interests, constrained by various things, and the collective upshot is usually better for everyone, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's worse for everyone. You can think of pollution as a byproduct of mutually beneficial market exchanges and so on. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I thought a lot about that, taught about that, wrote articles in that area, in that intersection. And actually, to tie it together with what we're about to talk about, I began applying these kinds of basic principles in the realm of, to the problem of antibiotic resistance. It's a kind of collective action problem. I consume antibiotics when maybe I'm feeling a bit down, but actually it's probably a virus, not a bacterium. Who cares? You know, I have some antibiotics just in case. But of course, when we collectively do this, we overconsume them, produce antibiotic resistance as a side effect. Same thing for animal agriculture, where half of all antibiotics go, probably wastefully. And the collective upshot is actually a world that's a lot worse, more resistant to antibiotics. So fast forward then, I wrote a book and a few articles on what would happen when individuals had access to reproductive technologies. And I was thinking mainly about gene editing, thinking about the far future. But then I started realizing kind of halfway along the way, actually, you know, embryo selection with polygenic scores, which we'll talk about today, that's already kind of here. It's right around the corner. So I wrote a book on this, and then I got tapped eventually in 2021 by a company, a nascent company, that was doing polygenic scores, you know, for embryos, and they asked me to join them, and I did. So anyway, nice. That's my academic background and how that ties in with what we're going to talk about today.
Now, you've thrown around some of these terms: polygenic scores, embryo selection. Explain to me, like I'm 10 years old, what polygenic scores are and how they're used in embryo selection, and what embryo selection is in the first place.
Yeah, good, exactly. We throw around these terms like embryo selection, as if everyone knows. Yeah, so the first thing, I guess, to say is that women who are either infertile or a bit older, or they have hereditary diseases that they know about in their family, have been doing in vitro fertilization for almost exactly 50 years now. Mm-hmm. And so the first babies were born right around now, 50 years ago, first in England.
I believe 78 was the first so-called test tube baby.
Yeah, that's right. So anyway, when you do in vitro fertilization, you basically stimulate the ovaries to produce eggs and, you know, combine the egg with sperm, and hopefully you get some embryos, enough to have a child with. And, you know, one of the reasons we associate in vitro fertilization with twins, with having twins or triplets or even more, is back then at the beginning, they would just, you know, implant a bunch of embryos and see if any of them took, you know, and sometimes all of them did. And it's like, oh, you've got triplets now, or sometimes none of them did. You know, but what happens about 20 years after the advent of this is in the 90s, the first genetic testing is done, and that's for chromosomal abnormalities. This is called...
Things like Down syndrome and,
exactly,
and Klinefelter's. Okay.
Correct. So this is called PGTA, pre-implantation genetic testing for aneuploidy, which just refers to chromosomal abnormalities. Now, you know, you mentioned Downs because it's quite common, you know, well, it's commonly understood, but actually the majority of these are incompatible with life. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is this would, in the vast majority of cases, if you implanted one of these embryos, the body will actually reject it. It's a so-called spontaneous abortion. And so one reason you don't see twinning anymore is this PGTA test is pretty accurate. And so what they do is then test the embryos, stage one, right, to see if they have one of these terrible chromosomal abnormalities. And, you know, they're going to set those aside.
So that we don't waste the implantation on an embryo that will never, ever be viable.
That's right. And so instead, you're going to, of course, if you're going to implant an embryo and you have multiple, you're not going to deliberately implant the one with chromosomal abnormalities. So now you don't get much twinning because, generally speaking, you implant one and it'll work. And if it doesn't, you would implant another one. But yeah, those are the first genetic tests. And so you've already got, quote, embryo selection really right off the bat. There's the there's the embryologist looking at it visually. It's not very accurate, but you can kind of look at the morphology. It's a bit of a, you know, bit of a guessing game. And then you look at these chromosomal abnormalities. Then really shortly after that, you get monogenic testing. So for the thing that you mentioned, so for example, Tay-Sachs.
Sickle cell anemia.
Sickle cell, any of these. And
these been, one gene diseases you can inherit.
Precisely. And that's been done since the 90s. And that's already embryo selection. You know, you're in a forced choice situation. You know, nobody would deliberately implant the one with a really nasty disease. So what we're doing now is just the next step in this, in a way. IVF is old, even embryo selection is 30 years old. But what we can now do, and we'll get into the details, I'll just give you a rough outline, is, you know, you can more or less scan the whole genome of the embryo, and you either need to sequence the embryo directly or there's another method we can talk about, and run them through your polygenic scores, and you can gauge with those polygenic scores, what's the likelihood that embryo 3 will get, you know, type 1 diabetes or breast cancer? Mm-hmm. And of course, we're doing intelligence and we'll get into that. But I suppose before we do, let me just say, since you asked, what is a polygenic score? How does it work?
And yeah,
the rough outline is that there are a number of countries, including the US, that have one or more biobanks. And what is a biobank? It's basically hundreds of thousands of people, typically, sometimes tens of thousands. And these are, of course, opt-in. You know, you can consent into these. And what'll happen is, whether it's a private or a public biobank, they scan your genome, you opt in, you know, and when you have access to enough genomes, let's say 100,000, half a million, and then you phenotype those people, meaning you measure the outward expression of those genes in the form of height, or it could be, these are simple examples, eye color, hair color. Those are really easy to measure.
Or an IQ score.
Or an IQ score, which is much harder to measure, right? And similarly, schizophrenia, which would also be, in a way, harder to measure. You want to be sure you're not just asking people, hey, man, you got schizophrenia? You know, you better get, you know, a psychiatrist on the scene.
Are you hearing voices?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, sometimes, but usually it's just my wife, you know, or I don't, yeah. So yeah, in order to really build a great biobank, like in Sweden or the UK or Japan and the US, you know, you want to not only have accurate genotyping, but also accurate phenotyping. Mm. And some of these biobanks, for example, they do IQ test people, but it's not a very good IQ test. It's not a riot IQ test. You know, it's a 5 or 10 minute one. And you can get some signal from that, but you're not great signal. And then there are other ones that are maybe smaller biobanks, but they're properly IQ tested and you get a lot of signal from that. And so there are these trade-offs.
And to be fair, if you need to collect data from 300,000 people, you don't want to do it on just one or two phenotypes. So now suddenly you're opening up everything and you're going to ask about health and mental health and all, you know, personality and all these other things. It might not be feasible to give an hour-long IQ test. So we do have to be fair. It's not from lack of interest. It's not from, you know, problems with the tests. If you're going to collect all this data, we need to be considerate of people's times. You're not going to find 300,000 people willing to sit through a week of medical and psychological tests.
Time and money, exactly. It's their time. It's the government usually paying for it or some private, you know, whatever foundation. But yeah, to sum it all up, if you have access to enough people and you have good enough phenotype data, again, height is the easy example, IQ is the hard example, well, then you can scan the whole genome, look across the billions of base pairs that comprise our genome, and you'll see some common hits across all those people that are associated with diabetes or intelligence or height. And you sum those up and you get a polygraph score.
Variants more common for this disease or that disease.
Correct. So that's it. And then you can use those. I mean, if you have those polygenic scores, I mean, I like to say there's really three ways of using them. You know, a lot of enthusiasm over embryo selection, that's what we're talking about. But the truth is they're already used to explain the human past to some extent. Mm-hmm. David Reich at Harvard is explaining human evolution and, you know, when did people migrate to different places by looking at ancient DNA. And then you can kind of, you know, you could either run them through polygenic scores to see how tall were they actually at different, or what was their genetic potential? Because their height actually depends on nutrition and things too, just like with intelligence. But yeah, you can use these to help explain the human past, to help predict for yourself, like what's my likelihood of getting Alzheimer's disease, that sort of thing, and for embryo prediction. So
yeah, I mean, I took a 23andMe test before they went out of business, and one of the things I was interested in was my risk for health scores. And so that's based on, my risk for health conditions. That's based on polygenic scores. I also wrote an article that came out about 3 years ago telling educators, hey, polygenic scores are coming. You better be ready. Your school district, it's coming. And so, yeah, there are a lot of interesting things. David Reich's rewritten our prehistory almost single-handedly with DNA and these polygenic scores. Mm-hmm. And we've mentioned some of these traits that we can use to predict either in ourselves or in potential children, in embryos. What is the degree of benefit you find for different traits?
Yeah, so it's going to vary based on how good your polygenic scores are. So that's point number one. And that in turn, apart from depending on, well, you need some talent, you need some really smart people, speaking of intelligence, to interpret the data, because it's not going to interpret itself. It's not something you can just run through an AI. But on top of that, it's going to depend on, and so polygenic scores are also going to depend on how good your phenotyping is and on data across different ancestry groups. So for example, I mentioned, let's say the UK Biobank. Well, you know, with that alone, we can't get a very good polygenic score for intelligence, but we can create a good one for something else like height. So we're going to have to look at other biobanks. And some of those are going to have better data on other ethnic groups, or, you know, better phenotype data on intelligence than height or whatever. And so, you know, there's no general answer to how good these scores are. It depends on the data to which you have access, the how good your team is putting them together. And then, and this is the crucial bit, you know, how good your validation studies are. And, you know, one of the people on our team, Alex Young, is, you know, someone who's pioneered this idea of family within family studies. And the really simple version of that is, you know, in the context of embryo selection, rather than explaining the human past, let's say, or individual prediction about your health, you know, you're talking about, you know, embryos that share half their DNA from each parent, and they're just as related to each other, more or less, right, as existing grown siblings are, right? And so the gold standard for figuring out how good your polygenic scores are for embryos is to run the DNA of existing adult siblings through your polygenic scores and then predict and see how good is your predictor for height, for eye color? Actually, we're not doing eye color right now, but for diabetes, whatever the case is, and they're going to vary, right? And so what our job is, and I think the really responsible thing that companies need to do is show exactly, you know, how much of the genetic variance that they can explain with their polygenic scores, and that's going to vary by trait.
I see. So for IQ, typical family comes in, they're doing this in vitro fertilization, IVF procedure, and they come to you and your colleagues and say, we want to select the smartest possible baby out of these choices that we have in the Petri dish. What sort of gain could they expect for IQ?
Good. Exactly. So we've got, thanks to Tobias Wolfram et al., but mainly Tobias, the best genetic IQ predictor in the world. And it's not even close. He spent a lot of time on this and a lot of time on carefully validating it across ancestries and so on. And what we've got now is about a 0.5 correlation. That's roughly, it's 0.47, I believe, within family.
Wow.
0.54 in the general pop. And what that means is that if you have, for example, three embryos and you're a European couple, we can talk about Asian, African, et cetera, but just to take that case, with three embryos, we can predict about a spread of about 8 points between the highest and lowest scoring embryo, mm-hmm. which is about half of the total difference. Now, with 10 embryos, we can predict about a standard deviation, about 15 point difference between the highest and the lowest scoring embryo. And that's about half of the actual genetic variance. And so the best way of explaining it is if you had, you know, 10 siblings, you know, you plus nine, you know, good Mormon family, and you've got 10 siblings.
Sorry, you know, I grew up in a family of five boys.
Okay. Well, it's pretty good. You're half.
Half. Yeah.
So, you know, the actual spread in intelligence on average for 10 siblings is going to be a little above 30 points, which is pretty wild when you think about it, between the highest and
it's
the lowest.
Crazy.
And we can explain about half of that. So it's really good at ranking. It's not going to get your exact IQ. You know, it never will, because IQ is not fully heritable and will never get every single genetic variant associated.
And we've had some episodes in the past talking about environmental influences, as you can
absolutely
imagine.
Nutritional.
So you're saying if between out of 10 embryos, the IQ expected or predicted IQ range is 15 points. That means implant the predicted, we don't know for sure, but the predicted smartest embryo compared to the predicted least intelligent embryo, we'll get about a 15 point gain. With 10 embryos, and with an average, compared to an average embryo selected at random, about 7.5 points. And I don't know about you, but I'm not going to turn down a 7.5 point IQ boost.
Yeah. Although, you know, hold your horses, because the reality is even our, you know, many of our earliest customers, we were in stealth for a few years, you know, really kind of trying to perfect the product and add new predictors and so on. We've got a whole bunch of disease predictors, of course. And so we had, you know, the usual kind of Silicon Valley types, people who really care probably more than average about IQ, probably know more than average about it, know some of the benefits, which we can talk about associated with it. But even they, Russ, even they very rarely just selected on IQ. In fact, I don't know of a single case where they did. In fact, I can tell you two cases right now, two of our most enthusiastic customers who really wanted to IQ max did not do so. Because in both cases, and I'm thinking, of two specific people here, one of them had their highest predicted IQ embryo was also the highest predicted for type 1 diabetes. And she was training to be a physician. This is one of the few people who has like authorized us to talk about her case. She's kind of been in the newspaper talking about us. So I can reveal her identity. And she was training to be a surgeon, but she has T1D. And that's a pretty serious thing. You know, if you're in surgery.
She then knows firsthand how big type 1 diabetes can be on someone's life.
That's right. So there was no way she was going to just like sacrifice, you know, T1D for a couple of points of IQ. That's crazy. And so she chose a different embryo. Another one, he didn't know that there was a risk of, they had one of the BRCA variants. They wanted a girl.
For breast cancer.
For breast cancer. Sorry. Yeah. And, you know, one of the highest predicted numbers for IQ had one of the BRCA variants. So it's like, well, no way. I don't want her to die at 35 of breast cancer. So, So the reality is there's always trade-offs. People are looking at intelligence among other things. And many people only have, you know, maybe four embryos. So, you know, you're not going to get
so much selection then.
That's right. So you're not always going to get some huge gain. But yeah, the gains are pretty big.
Now, you mentioned validation studies. How, in a short explanation, how do you verify these when these oldest children who have been born from this procedure, this embryo selection, are probably still approaching kindergarten? How do you verify that?
Good. This is the most important question. And I would say anyone who's thinking about doing this, for example, whether you're getting a polygenic score for yourself or your embryo selection, whatever, or you're just interested, you should always ask of companies or academics who are generating polygenic scores, you know, how did you validate these? And, you know, again, the gold standard is on existing adult siblings. What we can't do and can't expect people to do is wait for 100 years, you know, and see which of these hundreds of thousands of embryos that were implanted eventually developed Alzheimer's disease or whatever. I mean, it'll be nice when we have that data, when our grandchildren have that data available.
Yeah.
But
yeah, our grandkids can co-author on that study.
That's right, exactly. But that's not coming for a while. The good news is, or maybe it's not good, the interesting news is you don't really need that. And in fact, it would be an unnecessarily sort of rigorous demand for data. I mean, it'd be nice to have that. But the truth is, if you know, your DNA, as you know, it doesn't change through your life. Yes, there's some epigenetic things, but the basic, you know, the basic DNA that you have as an embryo, you have as an old person. It's really not changing in fundamental ways other than some random, you know, epigenetic stuff.
We talked with Yujing Lin, who's in the lab at King's College London. Mm-hmm. And she says that's one of the beautiful things about DNA and polygenic scores is it is unchanging. You only have to collect it once from a person. Just get a little spit and you're done. You never have to go back for that variable.
Exactly. And so given that that's the case, even though there are environmental effects and so on that we can talk about, if you can predict from DNA alone an individual's outcome or the differences between adult siblings, because remember, that's the context of embryo selection. An adult sibling has the same genetic relationship to another sibling as an embryo would to another embryo. And so if you can predict the differences between adult siblings, as well as the absolute, you know, numbers on, say for height or whatever else, of adult siblings, then there's just no reason to expect that it wouldn't work in embryos, given that it's the same DNA. So you can come up with some exotic explanations and so on. But, you know, if you want to demand that excessive rigor for that, then you should also be demanding it for David Reich. You should be saying, well, who are you to claim to explain the human past with DNA alone? You know, resurrect these people.
Build
watch
a time
them live
machine
their life.
And go back to ancient Babylonia.
Yeah,
test these people.
You didn't go to ancient Babylonia. Yeah, so
well,
how do
and,
you know? Yeah.
And you could make the same rigor argument for environmental predictors. I come from educational psychology where the default environmental explanation for individual differences is always family socioeconomic status. And when you actually crunch the data, the correlation's only about 0.3 between socioeconomic status and educational outcomes. Now, it can vary depending on exactly how you measure those things, et cetera. But you're saying that already within siblings, we're approaching a 0.5 predictor. I mean, that means that today, with these within family predictions that don't even consider between family variables and population stratification, all the other stuff that we spoke with Yujing about in an earlier episode, you're already making better predictors than you can from education's default assumption. And so if you want to make that, if you want to have that level of rigor for a genetic predictor, okay, go ahead. Let's also do it for an environmental predictor and say, okay, how are you validating this?
Yep.
Let's talk about what level of rigor you're going to apply to that, because it's weaker and explains far less and probably matters less than individual genes do. Or I should say the collective genes do.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Interesting. So you've already said there are parents out there today selecting for IQ, but even in the most IQ maxing parents, they're pulling back for some things. What are some other traits people are selecting for? And how do parents decide trait X is more important than trait Y? What do these conversations look like?
Yeah, good. I'm actually not usually on them because we have a full-time certified genetic counselor that kind of helps people interpret their results. And the truth is, you know, even really bright early adopters of this, and we've had about 80 customers so far go through the process at one stage or another, not 80 babies born yet, maybe a dozen, but we've got some experience walking people through, the genetic counselor does. And, you know, from my understanding and talking to at least some of the clients, you know, they're looking at especially disease traits. Typically the ones they focus on most are the ones that run in their family or that would have devastating early life impacts. But, you know, sometimes it's a little bit arbitrary. We did have one case, they didn't end up being customers, so I guess I can just say it. One case of like an actress who just obsessively, you know, it's like, I just want blue eyes or whatever, you know, and you know, we're not even doing eye color anyway, but you know, there's occasionally people who are like really into an aesthetic trait, or maybe they're very short and they just want like taller sons or something. But it's typically, you know, priorities are minimizing inherited disease. We have about, you know, a couple dozen disease predictors, not quite that, but close to that. Autoimmune diseases, for example, those run in my family a bit on my grandmother's side. So Crohn's disease, rheumatoid arthritis. Mental health is especially important, I think, to both men and women, especially women. Things like, we don't have severe depression yet, but we'll be offering that soon. But we do offer, for example, bipolar and schizophrenia, which are partly correlated with those. And those matter a lot to people, right? I mean, they'll sacrifice some IQ to avoid schizophrenia for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. So that's what it usually looks like. People are...
It sounds like most people are nuanced. They're considering different things. And that the monomaniacal, oh, I have to have my designer baby with blue eyes, is much more rare. And that when you get down to brass tacks with these couples, no wonder you need a genetic counselor on staff, because it sounds like it can be complex. Let's talk about the pluses and minuses of a dozen different traits.
Yep. And in the end, I mean, we kind of both accept it as a moral principle and a legal dictum, which is that, you know, informed choice is our maxim. So we don't recommend that you implant this or that embryo or prioritize it. We just try to make the numbers as clear as possible. And we don't want to inflate our predictors. Like, we just want to say, like, here's the best data we have for this or that trait. You know, we have an embryo comparison tool where you can just see, like, embryo 3, you know, like, lower on, let's say, IQ, but higher in terms of some other health score, and go down the line. And then we have an overall longevity index where you can compress that data and you can kind of look along a bell curve of disability adjusted life years and then see, like, what's contributing to fewer life years in this embryo. Oh, it's a high risk of schizophrenia or high risk of, you know, some autoimmune disease, which means that your body is going to be constantly attacking itself, low levels of inflammation your whole life, and that's going to remove life years or whatever. So yeah, people typically think about what runs in my family. Maybe there's one or two things that are bad. What do I prioritize? You know, some do prioritize, I guess, you know, intelligence over length of life. Maybe, you know, that's fine. We'll let them do that. And then, yeah, what am I learning new here? Like, maybe the way in which me and my wife, our DNA is combining is introducing some new risk in an embryo that we didn't know we had. And, well, look at that. That's elevated. I never thought about that. But I don't want to select in favor of it, you know. So.
Yeah. What about personality traits? Are those on the menu yet?
Not yet. It's partly because the genome-wide association studies from which you get these polygenic scores, those are still being done. As you know, they're less heritable than things like height or intelligence or some other diseases. But yeah, they're pretty heritable. They're usually right around 0.5, pretty moderately heritable. So, you know, I assume that these will be on offer, and I think. you know, I often get asked, like, what would you not let people select for? Or what would you personally not select for, or always select against? And I think that would be something like, you know, psychopathy, if we had, we don't have a predictor for it, but that would be one of those things where I want my
child to be a psychopath.
That's right. Ooh. Well, I mean, I actually think it would be a good idea to offer it precisely because people would select against it. I don't know if anyone would select for it.
Well, and it's the same reason for schizophrenia. I can't imagine someone coming into your company and saying, oh, I want to implant the embryo that has the greatest chance of delusions and hallucinations. I can't imagine a parent, number one, because, you know, it wouldn't be ethical. Number two, you're responsible for this child for at least 18 years, and they're a part of your life until the end. Why would you purposely bring that into yourself? Yeah, I think maybe I'll have a potential serial killer in the family.
That's right.
No one's going to do that.
You're going to subsidize it, spend your own time and money to have a serial killer. It doesn't make sense. It's one of the only things that I think that if we had a predictor for it and somebody, some insane person wanted to select for it, I think that would be one of the clear cases where we just say no.
Like we'll turn that one down.
But otherwise, personality is going to be interesting, I think, because, you know, I've talked to some experts on this, read a bit about it, but in terms of, like, you know, the field of evolutionary psychopathology, you know, it leads you to expect that, generally speaking, somewhere in the range of the middle of the bell curve for most personality traits is where you want to be. You don't want to be at the extremes of either side. And it will present some challenges in how you explain the various kinds of life outcomes associated with these things to people. But the truth is, generally, most of your embryos are going to be right around the middle, of course, of where you and your spouse
is. And traits,
You're not creating whole cloth, you know, new people with radically new personality traits.
And that's a good point with embryo selection, is that you can't select for what's not there.
No,
pretty sure. I'm 5'7". My wife is 5'2". We're not going to select for a future NBA player.
The genes
aren't there.
Exactly.
So on the one hand, embryo selection is new, and there's a growing number of people who are using the technology. On the other hand, making a baby the old-fashioned way is much easier and cheaper. Probably much more fun, too. So what do you think is the upper limit for uptake of embryo selection?
You know, it's unclear to me where that's going to be, and I think it'll depend in part on the one hand, people's objections, because there are reasonable religious objections. Some people simply will never want to use this, and that's fine in the same way Jehovah's Witnesses refuse blood transfusions and that sort of thing. I'm not going to tell them, hey, you know, I should force you to transfuse your blood or whatever. So there's going to be some who never want to use it, presumably religious, social reasons. I fully respect that. And, you know, there's going to be some who, maybe in 50 years, this technology will be, if not moot, mostly irrelevant, let's say, if gene editing is the game in town or something like that. And I'm not even talking about anything radical, but let's say, like, you could dramatically reduce the risk of schizophrenia more efficiently through gene editing than embryo selection. Well, then probably you're going to do that. Although I will say, in order to get the embryo, you probably will still have to do either IVF or
You'll still have to genotype the embryo in the first place to figure out whether you need to do the gene editing anyway.
That's right. So you'd still have to get it out of the body. So it'd still either be IVF or what's called IVG, which we probably don't have time to get into, but that's taking an adult cell, turning it into a pluripotent stem cell, then an egg, and then combining with sperm. Either way, that's, you know, so, but for now, I would say the next, you know, couple decades, the relevant time scale, you know, we're at a point where, you know, something like 2.5 to 3% of Americans are already born through IVF, and 10% of Danes. Danish people. Now, that's partly because people are going to Denmark for, you know, fertility tourism, but a lot of them are using it themselves, natives, and some of this is infertility. Who knows? This is speculative, you know, whether it's environmental stuff or people just waiting until they're older. And we do know that when you're in your late 30s, the rates of aneuploidy dramatically increase, meaning chromosomal abnormalities. And that means that even if you're technically fertile, you can have a kid. Maybe your body is having quite a few, quote, spontaneous abortions, because many of those embryos that you're doing, again, naturally, just through normal sex, are just damaged. And so it's harder to get pregnant. And if that's the case, many of these people then turn to IVF and then they screen those embryos for aneuploidy. Of course, we're doing a step further and giving more information, but look, it's already 10% in Denmark. My view is as people learn that they can dramatically reduce certain risks, not all risks, but some risks that may run in their family, maybe boost IQ a bit, maybe even a little more in the future, I suspect, you know, it could triple, quadruple. And, you know, we could talk about the moral status of embryos. I have my own views on this, but I think at the end of the day, a lot of people will want to do this electively because they want to, again, just increase the well-being of their children.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're right. And you mentioned opposition to, for example, the so-called test tube babies, in vitro fertilization. You know, I looked back prepping for this and there were some wild news stories and ideas and opinion polls in the 1950s, the 70s. Oh, a baby born through in vitro fertilization won't have a soul. I found an opinion poll from the 1960s that something like 60% of Britons and almost 70% of Americans were opposed to in vitro fertilization. It was plain God. And then the first test tube baby was born, and within 2-3 years, poof, goodbye all opposition. Do you think we'll follow a similar pathway in regards to embryo selection, or is this different?
Not only do I think we'll follow a similar pathway, but it'll be sped up by the internet in the same way that, you know, opposition can spread, you know, through memery, you know, whether it's on sort of Twitter or just through mass communication, you know, the news and so on. So too will reversals happen. I mean, you've seen what's happened to our culture in the U.S. 2020 versus 2025. Like, this is like a generational shift in 5 years, and it's kind of wild, like, to see this happen. Mm-hmm. You know, my view is I'm in North Carolina at our lab right now, and right up the street, I used to teach at Duke University. And in my department was a guy named Timur Kuran, who wrote a book called Private Truths, Public Lies. And the book was, you know, a bit of psychology. He's a political scientist, but it was really mainly focused on the end of communism. How is it that we went from mass support for communism in Eastern Germany to mass opposition where a revolution happened just kind of overnight.
People danced on the wall.
They were dancing on the wall, like, hell yeah. And 2 years earlier, they would have been executing people for this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of the story is, you know, to bring it back to IVF and embryo selection, you know, you get some people, once they understand, you know, communism is bad in this case, or you can indeed, you know, dramatically reduce disease risks or embryo selection, and that's good. You know, people will privately think that, and maybe they'll privately use, in fact, I know people who are religious conservatives who are publicly, let's say, ambivalent, if not outright against this, but have mm-hmm. privately come to us to use it. I think there's going to be more and more of that until there's a preference cascade. This is, again, Timur Kuran's view. This is what happened with communism. Privately, people were less and less happy. And then they'd kind of tell their close friends or family, like, hey, this is not working well. And enough people sort of understood below the surface that that was the case. And then when some elites or some people who were not afraid to say what they believed, maybe because they're rich or they're famous or they just, you know, they're uncancelable, so to speak, you know, then what happens is more and more people realize publicly, oh, actually other people think the same way. And then suddenly everyone, you know, not everyone, but large numbers of people are like, oh yeah, IVF's fine. It's not a big deal. Embryo mm-hmm. selection's fine. And I'll one-up you on your example. Not only was there widespread opposition to IVF, this happened for lightning rods. You know, I love this example. We don't have polling data, but we do know there were some crusades against Benjamin Franklin's invention, because after all, isn't lightning God's punishment to sinners? And if you had that view, you had a moral obligation to tear down every lightning rod. Instead, what happened is, you know, a few years on, people saw, you know what, you know, God hasn't.
I don't like replacing my barn when it gets. I don't like by replacing my barn. Couple God of years.
Yeah, Satan hasn't kind of come and destroyed me. Probably they're fine, and I think the same thing is going to happen here. So
I see. Now you mentioned gene editing earlier. There's one procedure called CRISPR that exists now. Now don't ask me to say what CRISPR stands for.
Clustered regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats.
Whoa, I'm impressed that you could just rattle that off. There you go. But CRISPR is a reality now. From what I understand, it's only good for very narrow, short gene editing. So maybe for some of those single gene diseases. But is gene editing for more complex traits across hundreds or thousands of genes like IQ is that on the horizon?
So I don't think so. I have no expertise on this other than I casually read the literature. And the only thing that I can say is I do try to keep up with the relevant scholars in the area. So I talked to a few people at the Broad Institute and the Church Lab, you know, after George Church. And my understanding is that, you know, even for single gene disorders, it's not fully safe now. There are still, you know, these so-called off-target mutations and so on. And you do have to edit really early on. Like right now, for example, if you have an embryo, you know, we wait for about 5 days. This is normal in IVF for it to the cells to divide maybe 150 times. They're still undifferentiated. These are not blood cells or anything like that. So it's not like a fetus. Yeah. It's just undifferentiated stem cells. But you know, you get 150 of them, then you biopsy the outer layer to test it for disease and so on. The thing with CRISPR is you'd want to get it right off the bat, right? Because you have to edit every cell, right, in the body. And so first you'd have to get it early and you'd have to be reasonably sure there are no off-target effects. And, you know, you can probably get that for one gene. It looks like the guy in China, he's a weird guy, by the way, He Jianku. I'm not a fan of him at all. I watch him on Twitter and he seems insane.
Well, but and I am skeptical because no one's ever verified his gene editing claims. And
correct.
You know, in science, we don't hide our results.
No. I'm skeptical it's even been done. But I do think it's perfectly feasible. I think, you know, it'd be pretty straightforward to do it for one gene. You're probably going to get, if you did it multiple times, you're going to make mistakes, but in many cases you won't. Mm-hmm. But this is problem number one, is these off-target effects. So that needs to be solved first. Nobody wants to screw around with their embryos. And it's important to say, we're definitely not doing that. Not now anyway. When you're talking about selection, you're just revealing information, which is, we've already been doing that for 50 years.
There's no genetic engineering going on right now.
No, but I do suspect, and this is, again, channeling friends that work in the area, in 20 to 30 years, it's a lot more likely to happen, so-called multiplex editing, where you're, you know, 50 or 100 or more genes. But again, you got to get it early. You got to have a really good system. And then you want to be able to potentially scan the genome to be sure you haven't introduced any devastating mutations. So I think that's a ways
off. Don't
implant
that embryo that
made
mistakes with.
I think a lot of people, in fact, I'm glad you mentioned it and that you're skeptical. I'm skeptical too of He Jianku's claims in China that he did this. And I'm even more skeptical that we're going to, you know, people will be like, oh, you know, the Chinese are already doing this, right? And it's like, no, they've got big problems. I don't think they're doing
it. Well, the Chinese government, which is not adverse to technological innovation, as we know, put him in prison for a few years.
Yeah,
I don't know if they proved that he did what he did, let alone whether it was successful. But, you know, clearly the Chinese government is not open to this. I can't imagine there's large numbers of people following in his footsteps.
No, I think that's right. And also a lot of the experts, as you know, come to the U.S. and other places to work. Some stay in China, but the experts in this area, even He Jianku, as you know, was being monitored and mentored by his Stanford professors. And we have the email exchanges, right? He didn't really know what he was doing. Yeah. And so, yeah, they really don't have the expertise to be massively editing embryos now. And I think it's a ways away. And in fact, I'll just say the real bridge technology is editing what I think will, you know, happen with our distant descendants is actually creating chromosomes from scratch. And in some ways, it might be easier than editing, where you're micro editing across the genome. It might be easier to just string amino acids together. I mean, nature does it.
Yeah.
Craig Venter has done it for bacteria. There's no reason in principle.
But would you consider that even the smallest chromosomes in humans, you know, the Y chromosome, for example, are tens upon millions of base pairs. That sounds like a harder job than coming in, pulling out a defective piece of DNA and replacing a new one. But no, when you explain, well, you got to do this really fast. You have to make sure there's no off-target mutations. You suddenly, building a chromosome from scratch does actually sound easier and maybe in the long run safer. Who knows?
That's right. And moreover, I guess we should finally say, you'd better have a good causal story in terms of the genetic architecture of what's causing traits. So like right now, we do have a partial causal story for some of the things we're selecting for, but mainly we're relying on associations. Like if you have these genes, you'll probably get these outcomes. And that's pretty much good enough for the context of selection. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to edit genes, you probably want to know all of the downstream effects before you do that. So,
yeah, that's a good point. And you know, we talked about genetic prediction with this episode with Yujing Lin, of when you make prediction, if your sole purpose is prediction, you often don't care what the causal story is. But yeah, with gene editing, you better darn well understand how this segment of DNA biologically has effects. And I could see that being much easier for diabetes and much harder for IQ, let alone extroversion.
That's right. I mean, one of the things especially interesting for you and your readers or listeners rather is, you know, we can have a kind of partial causal story, but not a full one, and that'll be good enough for us. Like, if you see that this genetic variant or this set of variants is typically expressed in brain behavior and not in, like, your liver or something, well, you know, we have reason to believe then it's probably got something to do with intelligence. We thought it did anyway. Now it really looks like it. But we still might not know the exact, you know, function of it. But we're kind of, you know, it's good enough for selection.
There's a difference between I know that this gene functions in such and such organ, especially based on my mouse models, and, oh, well, yes, we know exactly what this series of base pairs does when it tells your body to make an amino acid, which then forms a protein, which your body then does something with. That's a much harder story to tell.
Correct.
But hey, knowing where the genes expressed is a first step. And it's actually pretty impressive how much progress has been made on that.
Yeah, and it helps you build your models better. So, yeah.
Let's talk about long-term effects. Hopefully in the first generation, these babies, these toddlers, your company's already seen be born, grow up to be healthier, well-adjusted children with long, happy lives. What do you think would happen after two generations if 1% of the population is born through this procedure, or 5% or 25%? What do you imagine, you know, if we put on our sci-fi hat, what's going to happen in 2, 3, 5 generations?
Yeah, good. Well, you know, one of our mutual friends, maybe he's mutual friend, certainly colleague of yours, Garrett Jones, has done a lot of work on, you know, estimating how IQ helps predict certain kinds of outcomes in groups. And that's the context that it's relevant for your question. You know, if, let's say a country like, let's just call it Singapore or Israel. It's easier to imagine these small countries that are already, you know, pretty high IQ and wealthy and that sort of thing. And they're already, in the case of Israel, they're subsidizing IVF and genetic testing. So this is just, even if they never subsidize polygenic testing, well, it's going to be pretty cheap for them. It's just an add-on. So what happens if you, you know, 5% of the 10% of the country uses this and selects for IQ, it maybe boosts, you know, the average IQ of the country by 3 points, or you could talk about reduces the average rate of certain disease by the same amount. It's going to have economic consequences, but, you know, in Garrett Jones's story, again, since your podcast is about intelligence, you know, one of the most interesting things he found, which you're well aware of, is not just that on average, smarter people tend to be more innovative or make more money. If anything, I actually think some people overestimate how big those effects are on an individual level. You have an accurate view of this, but a lot of people think it's just going to massively blow up your income, which I think personality and stuff matters a lot, some luck. But from a group level, it matters a lot. So if you raise the average IQ of a group, you know, what you get are these really interesting interaction effects where you make each person within the group a little bit more cooperative, having a little bit longer time horizons, and those two are related. The way to show this is, as Jones did, and this is the stuff that I used to do in my academic world, you know, game theory and ethics. He would have his students play a prisoner's dilemma game or a public goods game. Basically, I'll just say the rough way of describing that is where there are short-term incentives to defect from mutually beneficial agreements, and then you get paid in the short term more, but long-term incentives, getting bigger payoffs if you cooperate in the short term and forego some big short-term payoffs. In situations like that, smarter people tend to cooperate more for mutual gains in the long run. And what that translates to is remarkable. It translates things to things like higher savings rates in your country, which is good for the economy. Higher appreciation for the power of markets and prices to achieve their desired goal rather than to command and control. So if you have a democracy, people who are a bit brighter tend to support markets a little bit more. I don't want to get political, but it's just...
That's just what the correlation is.
That's what the correlation is, and that IQ does tend to...
IQ and free market support are positively correlated.
Yeah, and you know there are obvious examples against this, North and South Korea, right? You've got the same population, and you know as soon as you have communism, everything's ruined, and they're brainwashed and so on, But when you look at these really interesting correlations, if you just boost, you know, 5% of the population by a certain amount, you're probably going to get more cooperation, less political corruption, which is an interesting point that Garrett Jones found. Because again, you know, I could hire my uncle or my brother now for this job that he's not qualified for, or, you know, I could have this more meritocratic system, which is better over the long run for my country, for me, for my own prospects. And so what you get is all these really interesting effects, which will translate to overall economic effects, technological effects, and so on. And even things like, you know, violent criminality is negatively correlated with IQ. And so as IQ goes up, criminality goes down. And that's true even if you control for socioeconomic status.
Yes.
I'm telling you things that I've learned actually from you and other researchers, but just for the benefit of the listeners. And so actually, let me ask you, turn your own question on yourself. One of the things that the answer to your question depends on is, does it matter for, let's say, a nation or a group's overall outcome, what the mere average of that group is, or do the smart fractions matter? Does it matter more like what the top 3% are or something? Do you have a view on
that? You know, I think that it's so difficult to get causal evidence about average group IQ and what happens when that changes. So I don't know, but I do believe in Jones's thesis that benefits that accrue from either bright individuals or bright groups get distributed out throughout society.
Yes.
And so I do find it plausible that, you know, maybe one day 3% of babies, you know, just like are now born with IVF, well, the parents also tack on embryo selection, and 2/3 of them select a embryo that would have higher IQ than randomly. And they have children and grandchildren. Some of those are selected with IVF, and this accrues. I could foresee a situation where even if my grandchildren don't do embryo selection, they still benefit from other people's grandchildren. And I would rather, maybe this is my time horizon, I would rather have my grandchildren be a well-paid middle manager at a Google-type company than a CEO at a small company being paid less with worse benefits because that Google type company never got invented by someone else smarter.
Right. This is kind of like, do we benefit from having, you know, some more von Neumanns in the population? You know, it certainly increases inequality, and it marginally makes me less likely to get that. Well, I would never get the job.
My grandchild might want that CEO corner office, but Grandpa Russell is saying, I think we're all better off
having von Neumann in that out office. There.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, who knows?
Can I quote Darwin on this? I was just looking for this while
You can never go wrong quoting Darwin.
No, never. So he, you know, intuitively understood this. I mean, with no numbers. So, you know, take it for what it's worth. But he says in The Descent of Man, it is most difficult to say why one civilized nation rises, becomes more powerful, and spreads more widely than another, or why some nation progresses more at one time than another. We can only say that it depends on an increase in the actual number of the population. Adam Smith agrees with that. You have to have enough people to have markets and so on. On the number of men endowed with high intellectual and moral faculties, personality, morality, as well as on their standard of excellence. And I love this passage because it shows you both, he kind of intuitively understood IQ matters, but it's not the only thing. Yeah. Virtue matters, personality matters, and the standards of excellence, both the social norms around you and the government policies and so on,
so
and they all interact.
Culture and political systems matter too.
They really matter, and so I do think other things equal, sure, boosting the IQ of a society by a few points, probably a good thing, given Garrett Jones's study. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's everything. I think these other things matter a lot. So,
last question before we wrap up, let's try to keep this one succinct, but I think of the other flip side. Are there downsides with multi-generation selection for things like IQ? In the book Brave New World, which as much as people talk about it, not enough people read it, there is a section where Huxley describes an experiment that this future society engaged in where they had an island, if I remember right, Cyprus, where they put all of the high IQ people there. And the society there falls apart because they realize we do need people of all IQ ranges for a functional society. So do you think that's a legitimate concern if maybe one day most babies are born with embryo selection and every parent is in an arms race to get the smartest baby possible? Do you think that there's a problem where we realize too late we need your average Joe salt of the earth who mows his lawn and keeps society going, you know, goes to the power plant and runs it? What do you think?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, it's very unlikely that we're ever going to get a situation where we just have two kinds of people. You know, it's stratified, like the selected and the unselected, or enhanced and unenhanced. There's already a huge distribution, as you know, of personality traits, intelligence, and so on. And all you can do is, first of all, select your partner, which is by far the most important thing, and then kind of around the edges, you know, a few points. Even if you had a perfect IQ predictor, you're not going to be able to get anything out of range of the random assortment of the genes of you and your partner, unless you're talking about, you know, massive gene editing and so on. So there's that point to be made. Secondly, I think that if everyone moved to the right a little bit, if the average IQ, well, it's always going to be indexed at 100, but if everyone just got a little bit smarter, both those at the left side and on the right side, we all just shifted the goalpost. I don't think that's necessarily bad. It's probably good. And if you think, you meaning the hypothetical person out there, thinks like we're at the optimal point right now, why? Why would you think that where we are exactly at this moment and not 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago is somehow optimal? I mean, traits and distributions of traits are always changing. Evolution doesn't stop, and culture just speeds it up, whether it's driving our IQ down or up or sideways and selecting for weird personality traits. This is happening and shall always happen through cultural norms and sexual selection. The only question is, you know, are we going to deliberately do it just a little bit beyond the kind of non-deliberate bit? And, you know, my view is, if everyone was just a bit smarter, it'd probably be good. I don't have strong views on it. But what I think Huxley's point is actually a little different than what he himself thought it was. I wrote a paper with Julian Savulescu and Chris Gingell, two philosophers who support, as they call it, genetic enhancement some years ago, called Great Minds Think Different. And in our paper, what we were doing is saying, well, when people can select for personality, it turns out I think as a society, we benefit from a variety of personality traits. And what we concluded there is probably, first of all, people will not want to select in only one direction.
Yeah.
They're going to select in different ones. And if anything, the problem is we're going to get too much diversity, not enough diversity. And so I'm not worried at all about the Huxley problem.
As an introvert who married an extrovert, I could see that being an issue.
Exactly. I think the worry that Huxley is right to express, and by the way, you know, Aldous Huxley and his brother Julian Huxley were lifelong supporters of what we would now call, you know, genetic enhancement. They would have called it eugenics, but they always meant individual eugenics. They always meant, you know, using genetic knowledge to whether choose a partner, children, etc. Julian
yes,
was
because
more...
Brave New World is not, it's supposed to be dystopian. He is warning us in many
ways.
But
it's not
about
a warning.
This compulsory society-wide.
That's right.
Situation.
So it's a warning against compulsory government-sponsored eugenics. But his last book explores this topic again, and he's in favor of individual selection and even, you know, sperm donors and this sort of thing. You know, he's imagining all kinds of kind of strange utopias. It's a novel, right? It's not a blueprint for society. But I think Huxley and his brother, Julian, they drew exactly the right lessons from World War II, which is maybe we were a little too enthusiastic about what the state could do in terms of like improving the human population. But we were not overly enthusiastic when it comes to thinking, well, the traits that make us human are heritable, the traits that really, you know, predict a good life, like having a decent level of empathy, intelligence, health. These are heritable. They're good. It's good to encourage these things. It's just that the state should not be the agent doing it. And so Aldous Huxley, even as he writes Brave New World, which is a parable against state control, still supported, you know, thinking about, you know, insights from genetics to help guide our reproductive choices. Yeah. So I think he drew exactly the right lesson.
Interesting. I will say, I just like the Huxleys, am strongly against compulsory decisions about reproduction, which spans a wide range of possible interventions. We haven't even scratched, you know, the surface of a lot of them, because state compulsion to such private decisions rarely ends well.
Exactly.
But I see that as also a lesson from history, from the early and mid 20th century. I will say that where we're going with this, there is a huge difference between, that Brave New World state mandated compulsory genetic engineering and, if you want to, you can select your embryo or not.
Right.
There's a huge difference. It's the difference between freedom and not having freedom.
Yeah, so I think it's important, as I've always said, to when people say, well, X is eugenics, therefore it's bad, like this practice, whether it's embryo selection or editing or whatever, or even assortative mating, you choosing, you know, a smart wife or something, that's eugenics, so it's bad. I always like to say, like, you can't settle a moral or political dispute by just defining away the dispute, you know, like just labeling something, because the truth is, you know, when you think of laws that ban incest, those are not only eugenic laws, they're state-sponsored coercive eugenic laws, and they're good, you know, but obviously that's not what we mean when we're talking about state-sponsored coercive eugenics being bad. We're talking about the state controlling your reproductive choices that are otherwise, you know, voluntary and reasonable. I mean, it's not reasonable to have children with your sibling or possibly even a cousin. You know, this is a real problem in the Middle East right now with cousin marriage. Yeah. And so the truth is, you know, we can't just sort of, I don't know, have a stick a turn out there, a term
Here's
out there
a dirty
like eugenics.
Word.
and say this is bad or whatever, forget the term. What really matters is, should we be allowing the state to control these really intimate choices? And the answer, I think we both agree, is no. And is it better if people are allowed to have information about their genetics and their embryos, or should the government control that information? And I think, again, the answer is no. You know, we have a long and bad history, the history, of course, of eugenics from the early 20th century that we can learn from. And so I think it's clear, you know, what we're doing, obviously, I think is fine and even good, but the key is that people should be able to opt into this. I do not want a world in which they're forced to use our company or we put pressure on them. Mm-hmm. All we want to do is, to people who are interested in this, supply them with the best information we can and let them make their choices.
You know, the whole idea of, if we make society a couple IQ points smarter, that can benefit many people. That's been the justification in the education world for things like gifted education for over 100 years. We need to nurture these talents, let these kids grow up, be our physicians, be our engineers, be our scientists, so that we can all benefit. So the same logic works for why we need gifted education, why we need elite universities, as well, embryo selection should be permitted also.
And it's even compulsory in the case of education.
We force kids to go to school.
You're boosting abilities, you know.
I think that society is better off because we force people to go to school for 10 plus years, depending on the country. And so, you know, if we've seen those knockoff benefits from increased literacy, maybe there are knockoff benefits that will accrue in 1, 2, 3 generations from embryo selection for IQ. Who knows?
The difference being that we just allow it rather than make it compulsory. Exactly.
So. I wholeheartedly agree. Well, thank you, Jonathan Nomaly, for joining us for the IQ'd Human Intelligence podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please do watch Eugene Lin's episode. I've already mentioned it a couple times. We also have a great episode about the education side from Karen Rambo Hernandez, talking about the variability in cognitive achievement in kids, which is surprisingly large, just like it is within families. Please like and subscribe to the podcast and visit the links to both Harris site and to Riot IQ. You can find those beneath the video in the description. Thanks for coming with us, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me. Great discussion.